One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
You know, one of the things we've actually learned over the years is that Midweek Drivettes have a resilience that is actually tremendous in so many ways. And one of the Midweek Drivettes, who in her own way has proven to be resilient, charming, generally outrageously wonderful in so many ways, is, of course, the fabulous Liz Brewer. Liz, always a delight to welcome you back to the program. How are you?
Hello, Alex. I'm very well indeed. What a lovely intro.
You know, we actually craft the word for each sort of stage of this to actually ensure it's all positive from that point of view. So this year, I think we can thankfully say that although we're living with COVID, we're not being affected by COVID, or at least not as badly as we have been certainly for the previous 2 years, where certainly the season was hugely affected. I know, Liz, you kept going bravely through a variety of systems. Got to ask the first question, how has it been vis-a-vis Royal Ascot, vis-a-vis clearly Wimbledon, all the other sort of areas? Are things getting back to a kind of normalcy? Because our general feeling was that things are sort of back, but there's still a slight reserve, shall we say.
You know, Alex, there's actually a difference in people's attitude and in their behaviour. People seem to be far more open now and relaxed and determined to enjoy themselves. I mean, think having had 2 years where we've been so cut off and a lot of people isolated, and things have sort of been cancelled, and celebrations, etc., and commiserations as well. So I think what I've noticed, I mean, with Asker, it just seems to be bigger than ever. And they're relaxing some of the formality. You know, the one thing about Britain is that we do cater for everyone. So with something like Ascot, yes, you have the royal enclosure. You want to be in the royal enclosure and lucky enough to be able to enter, you have to conform to the rules, and the rules are rigid. And this year, actually, funny, as I tell you a funny story, because my brother went on a day that I didn't go. I couldn't go on the Friday. And when he walked in, they looked at his shoes, and you have to wear black shoes. And his were a dark navy, very smart shoes. But true to form, he was challenged and he was taken into, he said, well, what am I going to do? I can't drive all the way back to Old Minster Lovell. And they said, no. And they took him into a tent where, of course, they hire you a pair of suitable shoes. They don't take credit cards. They only take cash, which was a bit of a problem. But anyway, they did that. And he sort of felt that was actually one step too far. And I rather agree with him. You know, you have the rules and people should abide by them. But I think you have to be lenient when it's sort of, as it were, on the cusp. So, but they were taking it seriously. But I was amused by the fact that you couldn't pay with credit cards. So somebody's making a mint.
I'm intrigued, actually, Liz, because it reminds me of a social media post I think you put up a few months back about a young Liz Brewer who was also escorted to actually get a skirt as opposed to
a proper dress. Oh, you're so right.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the most traumatic moment of my life. I mean, we're going back years. Sadly, my cousin Martin died about 4 years ago, but he was the vice chairman of the East India Club. And they had rules, and I was going, I think it was the first time I was going for lunch, and it was a hot date, and I'd arrived back in this country. I'd been skiing in Aspen, and I had bought a very smart pair of top designers velvet jodhpurs. I mean, they were not jodhpurs to ride in, they were jodhpurs, a fashion statement, and a wonderful handmade lace blouse. It was all I could afford at the time, and I spent all my holiday money on it. And so I thought, this is the right outfit to wear for the East India. And then it was called East Indian Sports Club. So I thought, this is perfect, you know, the brown velvet jumpers, etc. And it was the first time I was having lunch with this young man. And I arrived, I was so excited. And as I walked in, they greeted me with, "You're wearing trousers, you can't come in." And they produced this long grey Cortel skirt in sort of Cortel. And it was so ghastly. And I had to go and change and take off my beautiful brown velvet jodhpurs and wear this ghastly grey skirt. And of course, it absolutely ruined the lunch to the extent that, although I did have another date with the young man, but it just totally ruined it. So, yes, I was at a breakfast the other morning and it all flooded back.
Yeah, I sensed your pain, Liz, across the time periods, across the sort of the years. I sensed the pain. And curious enough, having just had the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society's annual event here, of course, our Lincolnshire show, which was back in full force, one of our correspondents there was also an American who I thought might have been joining us today, but sadly, I don't think she can quite get into the room. But she was also concerned about, again, what dress should you be wearing? What is the format? Because there is, even for country shows, there is a kind of need to ensure that you do, if not necessarily fulfill to a uniform code, you certainly need to have an awareness of what the phrase smart casual might well be, for instance.
But this is the thing about Britain. We do have dress codes, and much to a lot of other people in the world, to their amusements, a lot of them, they're difficult to explain. But it's something to do with Britain, and we've always had them, and we have to conform to them. A bit like Henley, because I remember the same thing happening at Henley, where you had to wear the skirt below the knee. And one year I was a guest of the chairman and a wonderful guy called Dan Topolsky. And Dan used to sit in the chair, the sort of the judge's chair, as it were. And his father was a great cartoonist. Anyway, he'd invited me and I was having lunch with the chairman. And they asked me if I would bring, as a guest, Ivana Trump. And as Ivana was my client at the time, I thought, great, yes. So I spoke to Ivana and I said, incidentally, you have to wear a skirt below the knee. And her reaction was, "Avelzi, well, if I have to wear the skirt below the knee, I will not be going to Henley." And true to her word, she didn't. And I invited another friend of mine who also was a client at the time. And she was just putting a play on at the Haymarket, Aspen Papers, with Christopher Reeve, believe it or not. I'm going back a long time, a Vanessa Redgrave. And it was an amazing production. And she was the executive producer. So I said, this is the deal. And she said, I'll go with you on condition I can decide what we wear. And she'd chosen from this Rightly Smart shop in the West End. It was, I can only describe, it was full length, but the top half to the thighs was like most beautiful linen tennis skirt, and with little pleats and a flap. And then it was white chiffon to the ankles with a slit up the side. So I naturally, I rang the chairman's office and I spoke to the secretary. I said, look, I have to explain what I'll be wearing this day at Henley Regatta. And explained it in detail. And I sent a photograph and she said, that's fine. Slits are okay and transparent from the thigh is fine. So needless to say, we arrived. As we get to the gate, the barrier, and all the press are there, and this woman comes up with her tape measure, and I said, don't do this, please don't do this. And she said, no, I've got to do this. And of course, the press started taking photographs. The girl, Mona Bowens, was high profile then. And anyway, they took the photographs, and we're waiting, and eventually the chairman came and he said, no, no, it's okay. By which time, of course, the photographs were all in the following days, all the gossip columns and Daily Mail, Nigel Pence's column. I found actually the photograph the other day, as you know, I've been going through all my files. And I laughed when I looked back at that. But we have these rules, and fair enough. But that was a mistake.
It is intriguing, though, because obviously from a gender balance perspective, probably the most radical change I've noticed in terms of the male side of things is how actually the Windsor knotted tie seems to be becoming a thing of the past, that actually more and more, even in terms of presentations, we're still seeing them, they're still present from that point of view. But I have to confess, for this interview I'm doing with Liz at the moment, I'm not wearing a tie. I know, it's a shocker. It probably started in lockdown and continued from thence, really.
I know, except I have noticed, I was watching the news, as I expect everybody was this morning, on both channels. And
are you suggesting that our current Prime Minister has got one or two challenges, Liz? Surely not.
Oh, gosh. And they're all wearing, even the presenters, all in their smart jackets and the ties and almost de rigueur. And I'm thinking, isn't that interesting? We're in the middle of summer and you'd have thought it would be relaxed.
Well,
and there they all are, still in a tie and collar. And I'm often asked about this and dress codes. And I said, you know, look back 100 years, look back actually 150 years, and men were like peacocks. Mm. If you saw the fashions that men, and I think it's about every 100 years or something, we have a change, but we've been very slow this time in changing for whatever reasons. And yet, as you say, you know, the world's changed as far as people are concerned.
Liz, we're going to test you now. We're going to test you now with the benefit of the listener, is an image that I have to actually do a little warning. A little warning to when we have Midweek Drivettes using Zoom in particular connecting with us, because this is quite a shocking image. And in terms of your dress code and dress sense, we'd just like you to actually run your rule after this. So are you ready, Liz, for what you're potentially about to see? And I do say many people
don't tell me you're wearing swimming shorts.
it's not myself, but it is us. I still actually had to recover. It was actually an image that was taken last year, and here it is. You can actually see it there, a very shocking image. Hopefully you can actually sort of see there of indeed
the
country wearing an England shirt, obviously at Wembley Stadium. That basically has, I mean, I think many people have had to have therapy just as a result of that. Is that suitable? Would he have been allowed in to the Royal Enclosure at Ascot if he turned up like that?
Well, of course not. Of course not. No, the Royal Enclosure has very strict. But I didn't finish the conversation because they have a strict code. But if you don't want to adhere to it, you can go the other side of the track. That's where the expression comes from. And you can wear whatever you like within, Royal, especially for Royal Ascot, within that sort of compound. There are areas where you don't have to adhere to the code and there are areas where you do. So, you've changed your background.
I couldn't stand that any further, so I went back to my office.
I was going to ask you where you were, because it was very impressive.
Oh, well, actually, the earlier background was indeed a place I'm sure you would have actually recognised. And again, this is where we love the joy of radio. It's television without pictures, or it's rather the scenery so much better on radio, because this particular background was actually taken by our mutual colleague, Richard Fitzwilliam. Williams, I think it's Regent Park as far
oh,
as I
oh really think. Yes, oh. I sadly didn't make his last the portrait. He had an exhibition at the portrait gallery, and I sadly missed it. But yes, I have known him for a long, long time. So he took that picture, did he?
He was all over Royal Ascot, as you might imagine, Liz.
Yes, I didn't see him, sadly. But yes, I actually reminds me, I must get in touch with him.
Well, that's what we're all about, connecting. Every Sunday, he does his Midweek Drive Morning Edition film reviews for us, and it's quite extraordinary. So we're having a little bit of a challenge now, because I'm afraid that he's very much team Paddington Bear, whereas I'm Team Winnie the Pooh. I'm afraid that Paddington Bear has his moments, but for me, it's always going to be Winnie the Pooh, and I will stand by that.
Well, Paddington Bear now, of course,
has got seal of royal approval.
Resides at Buckingham Palace.
Yes.
So you're going to have to up your action.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's by the by. That's yeah. Another issue. Liz, in terms of, I would say, the way that we're heading through, I mean, here we are, nearly a quarter of the 21st century has passed us by. I know we've got a few more years yet, but we're in the midst of obviously celebrating the unprecedented, and I will use that term, Platinum Jubilee. Is there a sense that actually the firm, from your own point of view as a public relations professional, is in good hands? And I appreciate this is something I know that Richard would say, of course it is. But do you think as though actually the crises that all families actually are faced with are being weathered?
You know, yes and no. Change is always something that we find difficult to accept. And yet we do accept it and then we move on. If you look back over the last 2 years, you know, people deciding they wouldn't have the vaccine and then did have the vaccine and what we went through, we're isolated, we're locked down. We survived and we continued. And a lot of us have forgotten what that was like now, going back March 2 years ago. And, you know, it's what has happened in the world we're going into. We're one of the few countries who have not just a royal family, but we have really serious traditions. And it's what makes this country what it is. And it's the huge attraction as far as people flying into this country. You know, the Americans just love everything to do with our traditions. People come from overseas and watch the changing of the guards, go around looking at our various historic buildings, et cetera, the City of London. And we have, as I say, you know, we're always in the process of change. And we have coming up, you know, a future that obviously Prince Charles would immediately be king, and Camilla, you know, I gather is now on the front cover of Country Life and editing.
Who would have thought that would be the case a few decades ago?
No, we wouldn't have, but we change and we have to keep in touch with reality and we have to grow, as it were. You know, life is all about change and going forward, as is living in this world, and none of us really ever know what's around the corner. One thing that scares me is artificial intelligence, but I won't even go there at the moment. That we have, of course, William and Kate, who are, I think, such an exceptional example of everything that is right and truly British and what we're going into now in this world. I think people admire them. I think the way that Kate has come forward from the time that we first eyed her, as it were, and accepted her, and, you know, the wedding, and then, you know, children, and now being such a fine young woman. And as is William, and William has always been the more stable of the brothers, and also props in the very wise. And, you know, life is a growing experience, and we all benefit from experience, and we grow and we learn, and hopefully never older, only wiser comes to mind. And I think that we could look forward to a refreshing and a new atmosphere, but created through the background of where they've come from, as it were. We have a rigid, solid, fantastic background of royalty represented by the Queen, and which is remarkable, extraordinary, what she achieved and how she lived her life, and as it was a learning experience and taken very seriously, and to the extent that we have benefited from that, which is why, yes, we should rejoice in the fact that we've had a Platinum Jubilee year this year, and that going forward, I think, will be a reflection of that.
Liz, as ever, absolutely inspiring, because those words go together, Liz Brewer and inspiration. You know, clearly it's a double-edged thing. It's absolutely critical. But I do need to put those final two questions to you. So they are, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Midweek Drive today, being question one?
Yeah, as always, Alex, wonderful Zoom.
Yeah, you see, back in the day, it used to be telephonic links. Sometimes we'd have sort of state verbal interviews. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you come back soon, Liz?
I'd love to. As you know, I'm very involved with Shakespeare's Globe and have been since the very beginning. And I had a big council meeting with them last week, and next year is the 25th anniversary. And the plans, I will actually send you, a YouTube, which will amuse you enormously of what has just been filmed there. But it is a huge celebration that something like that, which to begin with was so hard to get accepted, to get people to go over, as it were, the bridge and trying to get money in to create it. And now, of course, it's such a huge landmark in London and indeed in Britain. So I'd love to talk about that next time.
There's an old Buddhist saying that goes something like, where there is choice, there is misery. Clearly that's something which still echoes in the 21st century with a whole variety of things, especially when we're talking about careers and what to actually choose. If you're at the time of your life where you're thinking, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? Where are you going? What's going to happen? And all the rest of the pieces, there are lots of key aspects relating to this. And to actually talk us through some of the impacts on our mental well-being and indeed on our children's well-being, etc., we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, consultant, clinical psychologist and lecturer in teenage and adult mental health. That's Dr. Nihara Kraus. How are you, Nihara?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. And we also have a spokesperson for the Talking Futures campaign at the Gatsby Foundation. That's Michelle Rea. How are you, Michelle?
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. Dr. Nihara, if we can come to you first, let's talk a little bit about this research in terms of some of the headline findings. I mean, was I too negative in saying that people are getting very anxious about challenges when it comes to thinking, what am I going to be when I grow up?
People are getting anxious, and I think it's partly because just negotiating all of the multiple options that are there isn't easy for parents and carers and guardians. And that's partly because, of course, there are so many more options available. And with the kind of prospective jobs market also offering more, it becomes very confusing and somewhat overwhelming to make to support your young person in making a decision that's right for them.
Is it easier now that the whole notion of a job for life seems to have actually been consigned to the 20th century, that actually more and more people are likely to be having career portfolios and be staying or occupying a variety of jobs during their lifetime?
I think that, yes, there are career portfolios, but I guess before that is how do you shape that development and growth of it? You know, how do you have those conversations? How do you explore amidst lots of bewildering choices, as you said with your wonderful quote? How do parents and carers support young people in making those choices? And how do they line themselves up with what a young person might feel really inspired to follow?
And Michelle, just talking to your good self for a few moments, why are parents finding it so difficult to actually discuss career options with young people? Is it a case of they're equally as bamboozled by the range of choice out there? So you say, I want to be an influencer, for instance, and a parent might say, what? What is an influencer?
I think that's a big part of it, yeah. We've described it as the job fog previously, and we surveyed about 2,000 parents earlier this year, and it's exactly that. You know, they're saying that two-thirds of their are saying that their kids are describing and talking about jobs that they've never heard about, so they can't offer any advice or feel like they can't offer any advice. There's about three quarters of them saying that because the job market feels like it's really fast changing, that's increasing the difficulty and that feeling of being overwhelmed about offering advice. And so for most parents, I think 83%, they feel worried that they don't consider all the options when they're speaking with their child. You know, it's true for all of us, I guess. You know, your own reference point is your own experience, really. And that's why we came up with the Talking Futures campaign to begin with. It's really to say, look, we get it. We know that it's overwhelming. And we've tried to put as many resources, whether or not that's just setting out in the simplest possible terms what the different routes are, what the pathways are, how to have those conversations with your child. And really, it's a big reassurance piece from us. It's about saying, look, we all feel like this. These conversations can be overwhelming, but I think a big takeaway is don't feel like you need to have all the answers. This is about good conversations with your child and having those regular conversations and trying to unpick and get yourself through the job fog sort of hand in hand with your child.
Nihara, as a consultant clinical psychologist, what advice would you provide for parents who actually are listening to this and they really want to take those first steps in opening up a dialogue to actually talk about what their children are going to do when they leave school, etc.? Because it can be a bit of a barrier to overcome, I would have thought.
Yes, indeed. So I've got some top tips that follow the acronym top tips, just to kind of give parents something extra in addition to the Talking Futures resources that are available. So the first thing I think that's really important is to think about the timings of when you have that discussion, and you have to make it a timing that works for your young person alongside a timing that works for you. Often we tend to approach things when, you know, it seems like it's the perfect opportunity, it's end of exams or end of the term, but it might not be the perfect opportunity for your young person. And to do that, you need to observe and gauge whether they're being receptive at that particular time. So are there any obstacles in the way? Are they perhaps worried about something else that might be happening? And if they are, then engaging with the thing that they're worried about first will help to then bring in and introduce new conversations around careers. I think also thinking about the wiring of young people's brains. Young people's brains are wired for reward. They're wired for short-term engagement. And so focusing on something that gets their interest, that gets them thinking, and that means focusing on a passion that they might have. And if that passion for a parent is something that's hard to understand, talk to them about helping explain, you know, get them to explain what that is. If it's about being an influencer, talk to them about it, find out what gets them interested in it, and then introduce the opportunities and all of the kind of other available options that there might be. And so have a two-way conversation, listen as well as speak, educate yourself on all of the different things that are around. There's loads of ideas around that are really helpful to learn about. And I think it's important to remain positive, particularly at the moment when there is the job fog that Michelle mentioned, you know, just to be able to provide a positive message and also to be able to be positive yourself.
And Michelle, as far as Talking Futures is actually concerned, could you just share with us once again what the Talking Futures toolkit is all about and how it can also help fit in with what Nihara has been suggesting there in terms of ways to address these challenges? So people want to say, I'd like to work in radio, for instance, or I'd like to be a radio producer, or I'd like to work for a top PR agency. How can they actually work on that basis?
So we've got sort of, we describe as a one-stop shop. The talkingfutures.org.uk website is sort of jam-packed with different resources. So we've got conversation cards, and that's a real sort of step-by-step interactive tool where you can sit down with your child. It will give you a sort of readout at the end about where that conversation has gone, giving suggestions for next steps, where to look. We've got tools that describe the different pathways. We've got cards that help with conversation starting. It's really about helping to shape and frame good quality conversations that hopefully will take the heat, the sort of stress that there can often be between parents and teenagers when they're having these types of conversations. And then signposting and making suggestions and recommendations, whether or not it is the National Career Service website, who I know has got some great information about options for working in broadcasting. So I'd imagine there's lots of great information about how to be a radio producer.
And Nihara, if we could just go back in time briefly, when you were a teenager yourself, was it a case of you always were cleanly directed to becoming a consultant clinical psychologist? Just share with us your own career pathway and how in a sense, this was something you felt, yeah, that's what I want to be, a CCP.
No, not really. I think that I was interested in medicine, and there was a sort of shaping in terms of what was available, but actually there were a lot less opportunities. And I think one of the things that was most helpful for me was to have the ongoing conversations that I had with my parents all the way through. So it didn't start just when I was choosing my A-level subjects, for example. It started when I started secondary school, and I think I really valued that.
And Michelle, similar question for yourself, or was it a case of I visualized this and I will be a spokesperson for the Talking Futures campaign?
Gosh, imagine if that had been. It's the passion thing's really interesting here. I really thought I would be doing a job not dissimilar to yours, and I really wanted to work in the media. But I think what's really interesting about these conversations and finding out more about related roles, I must admit, it wasn't until I got to uni and had some really great careers advisors come in and explain, look, there's more than just these types of roles that can make the most out of your skills. Have you thought about marketing? Have you thought about working in PR and those sorts of options? And I think the earlier that you can have those conversations, the better. And we're with the Talking Futures campaign, we're saying, have these conversations from 11. It's exactly as Nahara's just said, if you can have these as early as possible, don't wait to those high pressure moments, whether it's picking your GCSE options or waiting till the exam results and then a bit of a panic about what to do next. That little and often helps to shape and guide. But I think, we're all in the same boat. I don't think anyone's career path is
basically. Exactly. It's been fascinating sharing some thoughts with you. So, of course, talkingfutures.org.uk, the best go-to website for the moment. Michelle Rea, spokesperson for the Talking Futures campaign at the Gatsby Foundation, and Dr. Nihara Kraus, consultant, clinical psychologist and lecturer in teenage and adult mental health. Huge thanks, and all the very best for future career work, ladies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do the shake, do the milkshake. milkshake.
When it is time
for lunch,
a milkshake goes with your sandwich too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just have yourself
a piece.
See what a milkshake can do for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do it.
Do it.
All right.
Do the shake.
Why don't you do it?
Do it. Do it.
Yeah.
Do the shake.
Do the shake, y'all.
Lactose intolerant, two words which have become much more popular over the last few years and probably more challenging as people actually have to cope with their own dietary challenges and decide whether chocolate is indeed for them or indeed products that are related to dairy matters such as cheese, milk, and so on and so forth. So how do we cope with this? What's the best way forward in terms of lactose intolerance within your whole life experience? Well, we've got an ace nutritionist to actually talk about that, and that is the wonderful Jenna Hope. How are you, Jenna?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex. How are you?
Yeah, okay. And it's interesting that lactose intolerance, I mean, lactose is a sugar, it's an inability to break sugar down, but, is that just too simplistic a line? I mean, is it a case of if you're lactose intolerant, you could have some chocolate and end up feeling quite poorly?
So it really depends on the individual, and you are absolutely right. For people who do struggle with lactose intolerance, essentially they don't have the enzyme lactase, which is required to break down the milk sugar lactose. Now, some people will be able to tolerate more lactose than others, but the good news is that whilst there is no cure, there are some dietary solutions out there that can really help you to ensure that you don't have to give up your favourite foods.
Well, that sounds particularly good news in all sorts of ways, because clearly, you know, if you I wouldn't say are addicted to any sort of form of chocolate, I mean, although any addiction is questionable, but there are that sort of lines of where do you go. So what are some of those solutions, Jenna?
Absolutely. So there is a milk aid supplement, which is essentially a lactase enzyme, and that allows your body to break down the milk sugar lactose. So it's not necessarily about overdoing it with loads of milk products, but it means that you can still enjoy your favorite food. So as you say, if someone really does enjoy a bar of chocolate, by all means, pop one of these supplements just before you eat it and you'll break it down and you'll feel so much better. I think what's interesting is that research recently conducted by MilkAid showed that 25% of people can feel physically unwell when they consume lactose without these products. So really, we know that it can have a really beneficial effect.
Yeah, I was thinking about that particular MilkAid survey, because when you feel unwell, is that just feeling as though you're bloated? Is it a case of you're feeling a bit sick? I mean, what are the kind of symptoms if somebody's listening to this and thinking, maybe I am lactose intolerant?
So for everyone, it will look quite different, but some of the really common symptoms include gastrointestinal discomfort. So as you say, bloating, changes in bowel movements as well, nausea, vomiting and headaches are also really common symptoms. So if you are noticing that you're feeling slightly off after consuming dairy products, I'd recommend keeping a food diary and tracking your symptoms alongside that, and that will help you to identify whether that is the case. If you think so, then head to your GP. They'll be able to give you more information and do some tests to confirm that as well.
Is lactose intolerance something that has kind of become very much a part of our 21st century highly processed food consumption, poorly balanced diets, living strategies? I mean, or has it always been with us in one way, shape or form?
I think it's always been with us to some degree, but I think that nowadays the world that we're living in is definitely making everything harder. We know that our digestive systems are not working as optimally as they were due to high levels of stress, pollution in the environment, as you say, ultra processed foods as well.
I was also intrigued to find that parents often worry that their children could end up going hungry in social situations if there isn't anything for them to eat, because clearly from that point of view, if they do feel as though they're, well, if they know that they're lactose intolerant, it could be problematic in a whole range of ways.
It really can be. And, you know, people who don't necessarily understand lactose intolerance may not understand if they've got a child at their kid's birthday who can't enjoy the food that they're putting on. So these supplements can really help to ensure that parents are feeling confident, knowing that if the child has had this supplement and then they go and eat something that contains dairy at the party, by all means, you know, they're not going to be experiencing these undesirable symptoms. So I think that that really helps to put parents' mind at rest. And the other thing is that the MilkAid research found was that parents can sometimes worry that their kids are not getting enough calcium in their diet. Now, we do want to make sure that you are consuming some dairy products if you can, in order to get that calcium at a young age. And therefore, these supplements can really help with that as well.
So looking at the milkaid.com website, I can see the strapline, enjoy dairy again. And is it as simple as that, in essence, that actually you have a MilkAid tablet and that can actually improve lactose digestion, as we've been discussing?
So for many people, it really is as simple as that. As I say, it is about finding your tolerance level. And if you are concerned that there is anything else going on, or that potentially you have a dairy allergy, in that case, I really recommend that you go and speak to your GP.
Jenna, it's been fascinating actually looking into the challenges of lactose intolerance. MilkAid.com, presumably the best place to go to find out further details.
Definitely. And also the MilkAid Instagram, where you'll find lots of tips and recipes and advice on lactose intolerance and how to live a healthier, happier life consuming lactose.
And as a nutritionist, Jenna, how do you celebrate World Chocolate Day?
I will be having my chocolate later, don't you worry.
Excellent stuff. Jenna Hope, nutritionist, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
To that.
gotta work, work.
Well, clearly the pandemic had a huge impact on the way in which people generally deal with work, specifically when it comes to using technology to actually help them work at home or work from home. But then, of course, we're all told, get back into the office and work on that basis. And then, of course, we're faced with rising petrol costs. Then we're faced with rising travel costs and the rising cost of living. And what is one to do when you're actually looking to get a better deal for yourself, your family, and cope with those stresses and strains? Can you indeed use something like reverse retention? What's reverse retention? Well, we'll find out that and many more things from the managing director of people analytics company Vizier. That's the wonderful Ian McVeigh. How are you, Ian?
Hi, Alex. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. There's a lot in that introduction there in terms of where we've been over the last few years globally, not just as a nation, and in terms of obviously how our working habits have changed and so on. Was it quite naive to ever expect the status quo ante to ever be resumed and people to literally just go back to working in the office and say, yeah, that's great, that's fine, and you can put up prices as much as you wish and we'll just happily continue being wage slaves?
Great question, Alex. I think one of my favorite quotes is that the one constant in business is change. And I think, as you've just alluded, just reading that, all those sort of macro effects hitting the business world and therefore hitting employees who are also, you know, citizens and consumers as well, let's not forget, is almost a perfect storm hitting us today. And so the Vizier survey showed that 94% of households are struggling, or survey respondents are struggling with household income to keep up with the rising cost of inflation, whether that's food or whether that's petrol or whether that's energy. So there's a real pain out there amongst people around the impact that inflationary effects are having. And of those, you know, 71% say that employers are not keeping up with those rising costs, and 79% do believe it's an employer's responsibility to do so.
Indeed, the headline, 94% say household incomes cannot keep up with the rising cost of living. But even more interesting is this notion that perhaps bring personship, as there's a line here, employees threatening to leave to improve the employment package. You could say actually 40-odd members of the cabinet have left for other reasons as well, possibly more than just actually improving their employment package, but we won't go there. It can be a bit of a dangerous game, this, can't it? Or the whole notion of actually saying, well, if you can't improve, that's it, I'm off. I mean, we're not all Premier League footballers, are we?
No, it's a fair comment, Alex. And I think most employees go into work with the spirit of mind to do a good job in their job. And every employer hopefully equally wants to create an environment for employees that's a thriving environment that gets the best out of their employees for their company. So according to the survey, 79% have not tried these reverse retention tactics, sort of the threatening to resign, but 58% wouldn't feel guilty in doing so. And the Vizier survey showed that it's really rising energy bills, 67% is a reason. Higher pay from alternatives, 63%. And interestingly, a competitive recruitment market, 45%, were reasons cited as opportunities to be explored or reasons for potentially threatening a resignation. So I think it's really a signal at the moment from employees to employers that there is a real pain they're experiencing. They expect employers to help with that. There are other opportunities, in, as you say, in this shift that's happening. I think there's been a fragmentation of the employment market. And as a consequence, there are, other, you know, probably the number of companies employee to employees ratio has perhaps gone up.
And as you alluded to there, in terms of reverse retention, it's an interesting strategy, perhaps one of a range of strategies that can be used to negotiate approaches. I mean, obviously, there are other strategies. You have to look at the Transport Workers Union for another issue with respect to that. Do you feel as though that getting to a point of general discourse and discussion to start thinking about, well, how can we apply techniques like hybrid working, for instance, like not necessarily having to make the journey into the office or to the workplace all the time, day in, day out, 5-6 days a week, etc., that actually working from home, as we said at the start, can be something which, assuming the broadband connection is there, assuming other things are actually there, and of course assuming productivity is maintained, which certainly the survey findings I've looked at seem to suggest that there was no difference, and indeed an increase in an improved productivity in many ways when people were working from home. Is that something that companies have to come to grips with?
100%. I think, you know, the one constant in business is change, and we're seeing changing environment, and with that comes a changing opportunity. So the survey showed that hybrid working or working from home, 79% of respondents said that they can save money on the commute, 47% on buying, saving lunch at work and sort of making that at home. So there are tools that companies can use in the employer value proposition to get that deal right. But it is all predicated on having the right data, on getting those data that almost right sizes to each employee, and that companies can take the right decision and almost personalize that value proposition down to an individual employee level. So tools like working from home, 31% said that would be a great reason to stay. Learning and development is another tool companies can use, and potentially even rolling out a bonus scheme. 45% of the Visia respondents, survey respondents, said that they'd welcome a bonus scheme. And of course, do you peanut butter that across all employees, or do you actually work out certain employees in high impact roles that you may wish to keep? And how do you work through that? And for an employer to do that, they need to have the right amount of data, and getting that data and analyzing it in systems such as Visia is a recommended way to go.
Is it also fundamentally a thing of needing to have respect for employees and have respect for all your employees, and to make sure that they are made to feel welcomed and part of the workforce, as opposed to, well, the senior managing directors don't really know I even exist?
100%. And, you alluded to it, to resignations happening at the moment outside of the business sphere. Equally, the great resignation is happening within the business world. And there is an element of war on talent and war on tools and skills and people. And I think every employer today is really looking, and should be looking, with the right mind of creating a great culture, a great work environment, providing a learning environment, a mission-led environment in the work they're doing, and ultimately rewarding and recognizing employees for the work they're doing. So I also see a shift to this, actually, from having been working 25, 30 years. Employers are increasingly looking to create a great culture for employees to work in, and employees, therefore, will seek those companies that create those great cultures.
There's a phrase that I came across recently, which again, I think sent some shivers of concern down the sort of general reader's perspective: management by spreadsheet. When we're talking about analytics and so on, Ian, how can we actually avoid that whole notion of, well, it's all about the bottom line and we're looking at these spreadsheets and this is where we need to actually coordinate?
Yes, that's a great point, Alex. And it should never be management by spreadsheet, but you should always be data-backed equally in the way you approach any analytics you do. So manage just by gut feel means you can have things like cognitive bias. That means you end up perhaps halo hiring or halo rewarding people that you like rather than those that are really delivering in a role. And data, and collecting that data and analyzing that data in a way that has some science behind it, gives managers ultimately tools by which they can work with their teams and make effective decisions. So, distribution of any capital that may be distributed, alignment of any, learning and development programs, and, allowance of hybrid working for those that most need it or most want it or most productive in it. So data is definitely a key tool to give to managers. It never takes away from that human element over and above it. But equally, that human element without data behind it can be equally damaging on the other side. So companies like Visia, we help our clients such as Lego or Experian or Merck, some great companies, really take that data that they have across their business and really right-size their employee value prop for their tens to hundreds of thousand employees that they have.
Yeah, fascinating discussion. We could go on and debate a whole range of things, but time as ever is pressing. How can people actually find out details about the Visia survey, Ian, and indeed the company itself?
Thanks, Alex. Yes, well, Visia.com, V-I-S-I-E-R.com. The survey results will be up there if people want to explore that. And equally, they can explore many of the solutions that we provide for some of the great brands I've just mentioned. So how do you, you know, stop, work on retention and pay, and lots of different solutions that we provide. So yeah, head over to Visia.com and you can get the survey results and understand a little bit more about the company.
Ian McVeigh, Managing Director of People Analytics Company Visia. Huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thanks, Alex.
I ain't worried about nothing. I ain't wearing a nada. I'm sitting pretty impatient, but I know you gotta put in them hours. I'ma make it harder. I'm sending pic after picture. I'ma get you fired. I know you're always on that night shift, but I can't stand these nights alone. And I don't need. But you gotta put in work, 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 work. You don't gotta go to work, 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 work. Let my body do the work, 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 work. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh, oh. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh. Let's put it in a motion. I'ma give you a promotion. I'll make it feel like a vacay. Turn the bed into an ocean. We don't need nobody. I just need your body. Nothing but sheets in between us. Ain't no getting off early. I know you're always on that night shift, but I can't stand these nights alone. And I don't need no explanation, 'cause baby, you gotta put in work, 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 work. You don't gotta go to work, 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 work. And my body do the work, 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 work. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh.
Oh yeah, girl gotta work for me. Can you make a clap? No hands for me. Take it to the ground, pick it up for me. Look back at it all, I'm for me. Put in work like my time, she ride it like a 63. I'ma buy a new Celine. Let her ride in the foreign with me. Ooh, she the bae, I'm her boo. And she down to break the rules. Ride it down, she gon' go. I'm gon' choose, she finesse. I fight bull, she take that.